The Irish flag is a sign of great optimism. It shows three colours: green for the Catholic South, orange for the Protestant North, and white for peace in between the two. I'd like to take a short time just to look at the history of this blood-soaked country, the green and the orange, and the total failure so far for peace to come anywhere between them. I'd like to dispel the myth that this problem lies with the Irish man or woman, to show that they are as human and as sincere in that country, on both sides of the religious divide, as any of us may be, that the cruelty and the savage fanaticism that they show is conditioned by the Irish history over perhaps the last 300 years, and that appeals to humanity and goodness, such as people never tire of making, cannot abolish those conditions, nor miraculously turn Ireland from a slaughterhouse to a haven of peace and freedom. First of all, I want to settle an idea that possibly has confused more people outside of Ireland than any other idea, namely that the Irish problem is primarily a conflict over religious beliefs. In fact, it is hardly ever true that religion causes wars, and in Ireland, it isn't true at all. That isn't to deny, of course, that one side of the battle has consisted chiefly of Protestants and the other of Catholics. Nor do I overlook the fact that men who sustain the bloodlust of the Irish people, those who fan the fires of hatred and fear, do so on apparently religious pretexts. It's clear they do. The Protestant clergymen in particular, from Henry Cook in the end of the 19th century to Ian Paisley today, with their spectacular bigotry and savage energy, have done more to whip up feelings in the North, feelings of violence and war, than any other group of people. And both sides have always claimed God's support in their wars, justified the most appalling butchery with appeals to religious virtues and the blessings of their priests. Catholics in particular, whose brutal and miserable lives always centered on the church, whose only consolation in their most grinding poverty was the belief that God loved them, will pray to him even in the face of the machine guns, asking him at least for victory to sweeten their fearful deaths. But even so, the history of their struggles shows beyond any doubt that Catholics and Protestants were launched on their battles and sustained in them by poverty and desperation, by material things, not by the church or its teachings. And even when priests and bishops called down fire and brimstone on the perpetrators of this destruction, as Bishop Moriarty and Kerry did in the 1860s, or when the southern bishops publicly stood up for the partition of Ireland in 1921, and that, of course, was anathema, both to the Republican movement in the South and to the Northerners as well, the battle continued unchecked. In no way could the churches be said to have regulated this battle. In no way could religion be said to have dominated the fighters. Rather, the roots of violence lay in political changes of a much older vintage. We have to go back, I think, to the 1600s, when six counties in northeastern Ireland, which we now call Ulster, were seized by the King of Scotland and England, the violently anti-Catholic James I, and were given to his favourites among the English and the Scottish Protestant lords, which resulted, of course, in rebellion and massacres without cease, as the dispossessed Irish landlords tried to get back the land. And in this way, Catholics were turned on Protestants, and the enmity began, which persists to this day. There is the root of the religious conflict, nowhere else. The most important Protestant victory was, of course, the Battle of the Boyne in 1690, when William of Orange landed in England from Holland, defeated King James II, and eventually set up in Ireland a parliament so hostile to the Catholic Church as to exclude all Catholics from influence. There again, you have the almost accidental turning of Catholics against Protestants. In 1791, a band of Irishmen under Wolfe Tone, calling themselves the United Irishmen, tried to shake their Protestant masters, but were defeated. They are often said to have been the original forerunners of the IRA. In 1803, there was another brief rebellion by the Catholic Robert Emmet, but this was savagely suppressed. By that time, of course, the Act of Union of 1800 had been put into effect by the English government, so that Ireland and its defence, which is the same as saying the suppression of its people, came under the control of the Imperial Parliament of Westminster. And from now on, it was clear that any attempted uprising by the Irish, who were, after all, only impoverished and landlocked peasants who would still take a long time to be commandeered by the industries of their English masters, any such uprising would be doomed to failure. But of all the tragedies to befall the Irish in this period, the most famous and the most conspicuous was the Great Famine of 1846 to 51, brought about by 5 years of potato blight and collapse of the potato harvest, which was so vital to Ireland. There were 5 winters then of severe illness, of typhus, relapsing fever, dysentery and scurvy, alternating with summers of starvation. The Irish peasant population, which stood at around 7 million, lost 2 million from deaths over the 10 years from 1946, and at least 1 million more fled overseas to England, America, Canada, Australia and New Zealand. The British government of Lord John Russell made hardly any response because, clearly at that time, the British Empire stood alone, was rich enough to survive without Ireland. Naturally, the Irishman's traditional hatred of the English flared up at that time and found its expression first in 1848 in the Young Irelanders outbreak. This was immediately put down again by the English. In 1858, on St. Patrick's Day, there began the Fenian movement, also called the Irish Republican Brotherhood, with the aim, so they said, of getting by force of arms an Ireland that was not merely free, but Gaelic as well. Not merely Gaelic, but free as well. Those were the words of Padraic Pearse, one of a number of men, like Sean McDiarmid and Joseph Plunkett, who today are the folk heroes of the IRA. Their arguments that they would never win from England the freedom that they saw as their right, no matter how many representatives they might send to the Westminster Parliament, those arguments were clearly correct. But the conclusions that they drew from it, that only war could be the answer to their problems, that conclusion was a disaster. The Irish MPs of Westminster, in fact, did seem to have the better prospect of success. Towards the end of the 1800s, under Parnell, the Irish Parliamentary Party several times came close to persuading the Liberal Prime Minister Gladstone to give Ireland home rule. In 1912, indeed, they came so close to that, that the leader of the Irish Unionist Party, a man called Edward Casson, created a force of unofficial soldiers in Northern Ireland who were pledged to defend it against control by any Home Rule Parliament if one were set up. That was the Ulster Volunteer Force. In direct response to that, to this new private army of Edward Casson, the Irish Republican Brotherhood set up an army of its own, the Irish Volunteers, who, at Easter 1916, mounted a brave but completely futile rebellion in the south, trying to establish an Irish Republic. That was a bloodbath, following which the English executed all the rebellion's leaders, imprisoned most of the Irish volunteers, and imposed martial law. Again, note, it wasn't because they were Protestants, or because they were Catholics, that these people took up arms. It was rather because of their economic and political relationship. From that time on, 1916, riots and fighting were to be a permanent feature of Ireland, north and south. In 1920, in order to try to defuse this increasingly difficult situation, the Westminster government passed the Government of Ireland Act. This created 2 Irish parliaments, one for the 6 counties of Ulster and one for the 26 counties in the south. Both of them would be subordinate to the Westminster Parliament. By that time, of course, the south in fact already had an unofficial parliament, or Dáil as they called it, created in 1919 in defiance of Britain, and overwhelmingly made up of the members of Sinn Féin. These people stood again for election to the new Dublin Parliament, and of the 128 seats in this official body, 124 were won by Sinn Féiners. All of them refused to take their seats in this Westminster-dominated Parliament, and it never met. But all the same, the Government of Ireland had effectively divided Ireland into 2 countries, Ulster in the north and the south. Irish politicians of Westminster now saw no chance of persuading Ulster to join with them in a united Ireland. And so, on the 6th of December, 1921, they signed a partition treaty with the British government, making the south into the Irish Free State, a dominion of the British Empire. That was the beginning of the Civil War, the so-called War of Irish Independence, in which the Republicans, in the shape of the IRA, turned against the southern government, the betrayers of their 32-county republic, as well as against the Northern Parliament at Stormont. The IRA rapidly became the voice and the sword of the Catholics up in the north, as well as the south. Although Protestants outnumber Catholics by 3-1 in the north, Catholics' outrage at the regular discrimination against them has caused most of them to take up the Republican cause with special ferocity. There is no doubt that they are brutally treated by the Protestant forces. There are massacres of unarmed groups of Catholics, such as that of a civil rights procession in Derry on Bloody Sunday, 30th of January 72, by British paratroopers on that occasion, which remind one more of South Africa than of Britain. Isolated attacks on Catholics actually put the British government before the European Court of Human Rights at one stage. In 1969, the Wilson government, acting on the recommendation of Sir John Hunt, disbanded the B Specials, a notorious group of Protestant paramilitary thugs working under the Northern Irish police, replacing the men with the Ulster Defence Regiment. That didn't help much. Because quite apart from the violence, Catholics endure unemployment at a rate 6 times that of Protestants in the North. They have much poorer housing and much poorer welfare services. They live mainly on the poor rocky ground west of the River Bann, whereas the fertile, low-lying ground in the North is owned almost entirely by the Protestant farmers. One of the Stormont government's first acts had been to abolish proportional representation in local government elections. They later abolished it in parliamentary elections too. By this, as well as by changing the boundaries of parliamentary constituencies and creating new ones where they saw fit, they took control of the whole of Ulster permanently into the hands of the ruling, Protestant-dominated, pro-British Unionist Party. That party has been returned at every election since that time. Many Catholics genuinely believe, therefore, that they have no choice but to join the IRA if they're going to protect their interests. And certainly, as things stand now in the North, that belief is quite understandable. Well, what is this IRA? In the words of the Fenian, Padraig Pearse, who gave it much of its inspiration, it's heir to a divine religion, a religion of destruction and of godlike justice, and the blood sacrifice of its members. Its object, when it was set up, was firstly to safeguard the honour and maintain the independence of the Irish Republic, a republic not yet created, but which they believed they could create in no time at all. Secondly, to protect the rights and liberties common to the people of Ireland. And thirdly, to place its services, that is, the services of the IRA, at the disposal of an established republican government which faithfully upholds the above objects. So there it was. Until the end of the 1960s, the IRA was a hopelessly disorganized body. Its battalions seemed to many people to spend most of their time in endless drill sessions with obsolete weapons, bringing disaster on themselves and on innocent bystanders whenever they tried to put those weapons into effect. For example, in November 1957 at Eden Tubber, 5 IRA men, 2 of them aged only 19, were blown to pieces by their own homemade landmine. And that wasn't isolated. Similar incidents were happening all the time. During the Second World War, when the IRA tried to work with the Nazis to defeat Britain, the German spy, Hermann Goetz, wrote that the IRA was as primitive as boys playing police and brigands. In parts of the South, as late as 1960, the Irish Special Branch looked on the bungling IRA with such benign good humour that members of the two parties would stop to greet one another, even in the middle of IRA training sessions. But murders still happened on both sides of the border. And Protestants in the North proved to be at least as good at killing as Catholics in the IRA. In fact, when the hostility of the Protestants to the mainly Catholic Civil Rights Association blew up in renewed violence against Northern Catholics in the late 60s, the IRA's response was so feeble that the Southern Prime Minister, Jack Lynch, felt obliged to set up relief centres for the poor victims and to campaign on their behalf. The British government then, afraid that this would end in Southern Irish troops coming to the aid of the Northern Catholics, sent wave after wave of British soldiers to Ulster to curb the violence. Since then, the IRA, or the Provisional IRA, as its guerrilla commanders now call it, has lost the air of romanticism and naivety of former years. It is now a lean and highly efficient murder squad. The high birth rate in the Catholic ghettos, the ready supply of men hardened in the prisons of Portlaoise, Longcash and the Crumlin Road, the many weapons from America and from the Arab states, and the continuing presence of the hated British soldiers have combined to make it so. As far as the new ruthless IRA man is concerned, any form of punishment is justified against anyone who supports, or even anyone who does not entirely oppose, the Unionist regime. The IRA man has the support of most of the Catholics in the North, and of 20%, according to a recent poll, of Catholics in the South. The invention of the car bomb and of cigarette packet-sized explosives, which can be used even in England, has forced the British to start to take the IRA seriously. Now, at last, we have, even in England, experienced some of the atmosphere of terror which is normal and everyday in Belfast and Derry, and which drives young Catholics in droves into the Irish Republican Army. I'm sure there are a few Irishmen who believe in the ideal republic,
where freedom and equality for all will be paramount. But most of them are swept along by a powerfully intoxicating blend of patriotic and religious fervor, which engenders such blind, even suicidal devotion to duty and obedience that they will starve to death for its propaganda value. That's all they die for, these hunger strikers in the North, for its propaganda value to the provisional IRA. A few, again, probably enjoy both the martyrdom and the act of killing. They must be a minority. The rest, made strong by alcohol, because all IRA men drink like fishes, fight because it's necessary. They see no alternative. And which of us would put up with what they endure without a fight? Well, now they have their republic. Well, not the 32-county republic of their dreams, but an Irish republic for all that. And in that glorious republic, poverty still remains. Fianna Fáil, the party of the republic, and Fine Gael follow each other in and out of Dáil Éireann, the Irish parliament for which so many died, and the only freedom they can guarantee the Irish worker is this, that he can be bought and exploited all his life long. He can devote his labours to the Irish employer, the Irish economy. They still have disease, hunger, and unemployment, still gross inequality of wealth, for these are features not of occupied Ireland, but rather of all of capitalism. Even if British troops were to pull out of the North, and Ireland's 32 counties became a sort of New Zimbabwe, liberated from the Empire at last, even then capitalism would endure, and the Irish workers would suffer just as they always have. The IRA has demonstrated perhaps better than any other movement that war cannot solve working class problems. It was a problem of the working class they fought over, namely, powerlessness. No matter if you're Catholic or Protestant, no matter if you're Irish or anything else, whether there's a famine on or not, whether you're in a republic or not, as a working person, you are powerless. To wage war merely hides your problem, makes it seem different from that of your opponent. And let's not forget that Protestant workers also had hunger, unemployment, and misery, and they also were powerless. War elevates violence to a virtue, forces young people to devote their lives to lying, cheating, and murdering. In the name of freedom from slavery and death under British rule, the Irish War substituted for it another kind of slavery and another kind of death, to be followed by just as much slavery under a new government, under a new republic. Truly, that is all that wars can ever do. Nationalism is quite irrelevant to freedom. The causes of Irish misery have always lain in the economic and political circumstances of Ireland, just like misery all the world over. My friend, Comrade Clifford Snapper, will explore these causes more closely with you now, and will show how a real solution to Irish misery can be achieved.
One of the most commonly painted slogans, particularly on the walls of Bogside in Derry, asks the question, is there life before death? And in the 14 years since 1969, 25,000 people have been injured in the north of Ireland and over 2,200 people have been killed in that war. Every one of those deaths has been premature and violent, and all of the people who've been involved, whether they're soldiers or in the IRA or the UDF or neither, have one thing in common. Every single one of them was a member of the working class. These people who have lost their lives in a war which is only an hour away from here consist of young men straight off of the Dole tubes in Liverpool and Glasgow and London who are now parading with weapons which can destroy thousands of human lives, and they're walking up and down with those weapons in rows of terraced houses which look exactly the same as the rows of terraced houses where they live. If you take an area like the Ardoyne in Belfast, there are many Catholics in that enclave who have not been out of the Ardoyne since 1969 for fear of the consequences. In the recent television history of Ireland, a doctor was interviewed and he said, one has just got to be blunt, almost brutal at times, through the night telling you your wife has lost both her legs, your young son has been killed in an explosion. This is the sort of situation which we're faced with almost daily in this hospital. And to leave no doubt about what he was trying to say, behind him on the screen, bodies were being wheeled into his operating theatre with hands and feet blown off, faces disfigured and with blood everywhere. This is what war means. So it's only right that we should ask the obvious question, faced with that kind of horror, of what the sides are fighting for. First of all, the side which is in uniform, the British workers who are supporting the rule of their British masters. Their position, their job which they're doing, has its origins in ownership. In 1654, the English Parliament ordered the English governors throughout Ireland to proclaim, and I quote, that all the ancient estates and farms of the people of Ireland were to belong to the adventurers and the army of England, and that the Parliament had assigned Connaught for the habitation of the Irish nation, whither they must transplant their wives and daughters and children before the 1st of May, following, under penalty of death if found on this side of the Shannon after that day. Property has always rested upon the guarantee of force. The profit system which exists in every corner of the world is based legitimately upon violence, whether that violence is coming from a bayonet or from a rubber bullet. What then about the Protestant workers in Northern Ireland who want to preserve the British way of life in the slums of Shankill? On the 12th of July every year, the Protestant ghettos in Belfast are adorned with pathetic banners which say of their poverty, this we will maintain. Of course, it's just as well not to tell these people that William of Orange, their hero, was in fact armed by the Pope, but that's something you don't read about so often in the history books. It's preferable to keep it quiet because it spoils the religious myths. The United Irishmen, who Peter Cook mentioned as some of the earliest Irish nationalists, ironically, were Protestants largely. That was an early nationalist movement, which in fact was if Protestant, if not secular. In other words, it didn't have a particular religious thrust. It was an early nationalist movement for Ireland as such. And as early as 1798, it was recognised by some of these people that it would be necessary to cross the sectarian divide, as this poem, written in 1798 by Janie Hope of the United Irishmen, demonstrates. It says, "Oh, Paddies, my hearties, have done with your parties. Let men of all creeds and professions agree. If orange and green man no longer were seen man, oh, how easy, old Ireland, we'd free." Of course, in 1798, that movement was crushed, and in 1801, the union was established with Britain. But political decrees, such as that made in 1801, are less important in this system than economic market forces, despite what the nationalists claim. And it was ironic that during the 19th century, after that law uniting Ireland and Britain, that a group of capitalists arose in Northern Ireland who, whereas once they'd been nationalists in their early days in 1798, grew increasingly to prosper and to profit as a result of their connection with Britain. That's in the north. It's one of the curses of the capitalist system of production for profit as opposed to human needs, that the competition which that system is based upon leads to uneven development. And because Ulster had certain economic advantages, which there isn't time now to go into, because it had certain economic advantages, the system of competition and of competing for profit led those advantages to be multiplied over and over, so that Ulster developed much more rapidly in the 19th century than the rest of Ireland. And that really is the economic roots of the war which exists there at the moment. Because as a result, during the 19th century, those who had been once independently minded nationalists became more and more Ulster unionists. The capitalists of the north saw it as their interest to remain united with Britain because they profited from the trade involved and from the industry involved based upon linen and shipbuilding and other textiles and engineering. Whereas, of course, in the rest of Ireland, although agriculture was developing rapidly and tillage was being replaced by pasture and by cattle ranching, nonetheless, it was far less advanced, and therefore the smaller capitalist owners of the south looked with cynicism and with despair at the link with Britain. They saw instead a need to build a strong tariff boundary, a wall of protection around their interests in the south so they could be defended from the foreign competition of cheap imports from Britain and elsewhere. In 1914, when the Home Rule Bill was carried in the British Parliament, giving a certain measure of autonomy to Ireland, the Ulster Unionist Council was formed. This was a group of businessmen in the north of Ireland and landowners and politicians who made it their business to round up all of the Protestant workers of the north and convince those workers that it was in their interests to support a strong Ulster Unionist movement which was ready to take up arms and fight rather than move into an independent island. So what is it in the mentality and the consciousness of the workers of Northern Ireland who are Protestants which for so long convinced them that they had an interest in defending British rule, and of course still does today? What drove those workers in 1914 to take up arms? Because the UVF was armed in 1914 for this purpose and would have fought if it hadn't been for the outbreak of the First World War. What drove them to be prepared to fight Britain in order to remain under British rule? The fact is, their class interests have been masked and hidden. They've been convinced that they must follow their Protestant capitalist masters in the North. Meanwhile, the workers in the South, largely Catholic, were being convinced that they had to support the interests of their slightly smaller capitalist masters in the South, who favoured Irish independence and protection for their early industries. The war in Northern Ireland, then, today, is a class war. The class war means that both Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland have essentially the same interests, not different interests. As demonstrated in this novel, recently published, Frank Faces of the Dead, which is written by a member of this party. And he says, the Catholics were tilting at windmills, following a dream that carried them through suffering, death and destruction back to their misery. They were slaves, desperately tugging at their fetters to break free, even if they sought only new fetters. They were following their leaders who had never glimpsed freedom, who were less concerned at the fact of slavery than they were with the condition of the slave. But the Protestant poor, they only made self-deceiving noises with their claims to warm the hearts of their masters. The fact is that most people in Belfast live in rows of houses which were built in the early 19th century, where the roots of this war lie. In the early 19th century, Belfast increased 8 times over in its population. 1 in 7 of those homes are now officially unfit for habitation. Just take as one example the Moyard Estate in West Belfast, where thousands of people live. Raw sewage is leaking out into that estate. There have been many cases recently of jaundice, gastroenteritis and diarrhoea, especially amongst children. And there was one case recently of polio in a child of 2.5 years old. There are rats throughout that estate. A locally produced pamphlet states that some residents have been bitten by rats and taken to hospital with the rats still clinging to them because they had lockjawed. In Belfast, unemployment is over 20%, the highest in Britain. 10% of people in Belfast are in one-parent families. It's the anti-human system of profit based upon control of society and control of the production of wealth by a small minority, which has led to these slums and to this violence and to this poverty. The Unionist Party, which ruled Northern Ireland as a one-party state for 50 years on the basis of religious discrimination, of disclaiming religious discrimination and yet practising it just enough to convince the Protestant workers that they were well looked after. The reward which was given to those Protestant workers in its small pettiness itself demonstrates the poverty of its recipients. The fact is that whilst borough boundaries were being gerrymandered and jobs and housing were being given to Protestants in preference to Catholics, the Catholic businessmen in Northern Ireland, because there are some, they got their extra votes as property owners under that undemocratic franchise. It wasn't a question of religion for them because they owned the property. And when Paisley led the Protestant workers against the civil rights movement in the 60s, why were those workers, those Protestants, so desperate to cling on to what they saw as their own small privileges? It was because they were so desperately poor in the first place. What is this ideology of Ulster Unionism which motivates that side of the war? Look at this old orange song. I won't sing it, but I'll read it. Against the altar and the throne, the Democrat may prate. But while I am an orange man, I'll stand for church and state. Let not the poor man hate the rich, let not the poor man hate the rich, nor rich on poor look down, but each join each, true Protestant, for God and for the crown. Now, we're glad to point out that there has recently been a very encouraging trend in Northern Ireland in which the Protestant and the Catholic workers are beginning to realise the cons that have been played on them for the last 100 years. For example, it's not much, but it's something, there is the cross group of Catholic and Protestant women whose husbands have been killed in that war, who actually meet one another, discuss how they feel about that. There's Andy Tyrie, who became commander of the Ulster Defence Association in 73, and he was quoted recently as follows. I grew up in Ballymurphy when it was a mixed neighbourhood. I learned that prods weren't anything special. We lived in the same houses as Catholics, got the same money for the same jobs. This realisation does exist. And finally, there is the side in the war of nationalism. As socialists, we do oppose British rule in Northern Ireland. But equally, we oppose any rule in Northern Ireland. We are opposed as socialists to new rulers replacing the old, new armies stepping into the boots of the old. And because the nationalists in Northern Ireland don't accept a socialist alternative, which I shall be going on to in a moment, they therefore fight a war in order to replace one set of rulers by another set of rulers without any chance of a socialist alternative. So you have movements such as Sinn Féin, set up in 1905 explicitly to develop Irish capitalism with an Irish stock exchange and Irish protective tariffs. You have the Proclamation of the Republic in 1916 talking about flags and nationhood. And finally, you have the Republic of Ireland, as Peter Cook said, formed in the 20s, with its state capitalism. By the Second World War, half of Southern Irish industry was controlled by the state, but it was capitalist nonetheless, as any of the workers who had to work as wage slaves in those industries would tell you. It had its protectionist policies to defend the primitive industry of Southern Ireland. But these protectionist policies, which lay at the root of the economic history of this struggle, were removed in the 60s. By the 1960s, many, many economic changes had taken place. The old economic basis of partition, according to which the South was less developed and therefore wanted these protective duties, and the North was go-ahead and part of Britain, this, by the 1960s, was not even any longer the case. In 1965, there was the Anglo-Irish Free Trade Agreement. In 1973, Ireland with Britain joined the EEC, and Britain was starting to invest even more and to trade even more with the south of Ireland and with the north of Ireland. So there were new conditions, but of course, the old myths persisted. What is the reaction of ordinary Catholic workers in Northern Ireland today to the IRA and to that, those policies which they're pursuing? Let me quote you one woman from the Turf Lodge estate in the Fools Road ghetto. She says, "The hoods have taken over. They hijack our vans, our shops. In the beginning, it was all our cause, our country, but I don't believe in it anymore." That woman has seen through the myth according to which she has to choose between the IRA and their nationalist capitalism for Ireland and the other side with their British version of capitalism. In other words, there is disillusionment and despair with both sides. People are looking for a new alternative. As we say in our new pamphlet on Ireland, which has been published this very day, and which is available here tonight at 30 pence, I've put in a quick plug for it. As we say in this pamphlet, the politics of unionism and republicanism have become meaningless in terms of the interests of the now largely unified capitalist class. And certainly, neither unionism nor republicanism, despite the latter's flirting with the vocabulary of socialism, have anything to offer the working class. British and Irish nationalism perpetuate the problems. They are the cause of the problems, not the solution. There's been a long history of divide and rule. Religious sectarianism has been fostered by northern and southern capitalists trying to pursue their once divided interests. If I could quote a magistrate in Dungannon some time ago, 1795 as a matter of fact, speaking about the newly formed Orange Order, Protestant workers who were worried and resentful at the onset of capitalism because they suddenly saw all of these Catholics being herded in to Belfast and into Derry to work in the factories. And they got a bit worried because up till then they'd been independent. They'd been the only people there with their as artisans weaving their linen. And therefore they formed this vicious anti-Catholic movement to show their resentment, quite illogical and irrational. But what did the rich magistrates have to say about these activities? He says, "As for the Orange men, we have a rather difficult card to play. They must not be entirely discountenanced. On the contrary, we must in a certain degree uphold them. For with all their licentiousness, on them we must rely for the preservation of our lives and properties should critical times occur." And from that date, the same policy has persisted until its present reincarnation in Ian Paisley, even though the more subtle capitalists don't bother to go in for that kind of thing anymore. And the fact is that British workers here in London support the state British presence in Northern Ireland, just as they support, on the whole, the existence of the British oppressive state here in London. In other words, it's a question of acquiescence to a system in which a small minority control the production of wealth and have to have a state in order to defend that ownership. Kenneth Newman, Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, who was once in charge of the IUC, has described Northern Ireland as a laboratory situation. You said in the Irish Times in 1976, "I have it very much in mind that British police forces would be faced with similar problems in the years ahead, not just from the provisional IRA, but from certain obvious developments in the demographic areas and urban developments." But of course, in 1981, he was proved to a certain extent right. What we have to do now is reject the religious submission of Catholicism and Protestantism, because they both preach submission to our rulers, and we have to explore a socialist alternative. What is that alternative? It is for workers, whether they were once Protestant or Catholic or British or Irish, to recognise that they have a shared united interest which crosses all of those barriers and many other barriers which people see as existing. The working class who have to work for wages and salaries in order to live, who have to sell their own ability to work to the highest bidder in order to survive, must unite across national boundaries incidentally, which our masters have drawn, we haven't had anything to do with it, and must establish democratically a society in which the principle will apply from each according to ability to each according to need. And that means free access to all wealth. That means that we produce what we need and therefore we take what we need. It's not a question of asking whether we can have a slight privilege by having one slum rather than another, or whether Protestants are going to get access to wage slavery but with preference over Catholics looking for wage slavery. It's to get rid of those categories altogether, to have a worldwide system in which production is not for profit but for use. If people want houses to live in, we can build not the slums of the Falls Road or the Shankill, but we can build comfortable residences for all of us, not just for people who can afford to buy them, because there won't be any system of monetary exchange in a worldwide socialist society. So we want to get rid of the British Army in Northern Ireland, but we take it further. We want to get rid of every army everywhere, and that is the only way in which to establish a future society of peace in which people can actually give vent to their human desire to work together in cooperation and to actually produce wealth which is going to be directly for people's use. And that task of getting rid of the present system and replacing it with a system based upon direct production for human use across the world without the limitation of profit, because there are no people to cash in on it, that system can only be established by us as a whole, people who have to work for a living. And so I'd like to end by quoting James Connolly, whose works we by no means endorse in their entirety, but who wrote a great deal about Ireland, and who had this to say: "Whosoever carries the outworks of the citadel of oppression, the working class alone can raise it to the ground."
The Labour Party seeing that there's a very large contingent of Irish people living in such a lot, and they are now trying to attack votes on the despite the reputation of the Labour Party. The recent attempts now is that they say that there are no attempts to reunify Ireland by reconciling the capitalist, the Orange and the Catholic population.
Well, that's right, but people have been trying to do that for a long, long time, and it's not until you appreciate that the problems which have caused the Protestants and the Catholics to fall out with each other are in fact created by the current conditions in which they live. Not until you appreciate that, do you really have any idea of how they can be reconciled one with another. And you're answering your own question. The task of reconciliation has to be the task of the people themselves, and the Labour Party can't reconcile them, and can't reconcile itself with its own trade union pals.
Can I just add something to that?
Yes,
briefly. Just to point out in relation to the Labour Party's record on the question of Ireland, that it was, of course, the Labour Party which decided to send British troops in 1969 and to pass the Prevention of Terrorism Act in 1974. So the fact that the Labour Party now has got some vague moves in the direction of what it sees as something progressive in relation to Ireland is obviously a very explicitly opportunist sort of vote-catching move, which says nothing, predictably, about replacing Irish or British capitalism with a genuine socialist society.
Another question, please. Anyone at all?
Danny, it is inconceivable, even with capitalism, that this problem would go on forever and ever. I mean, I know it's several hundred years old, but I mean, it doesn't seem logical that, say, in 100 years' time, this battle will still be going on. And, you know, one of the, what I'm saying, within the capitalist system, can you see a conceivable solution? Not that we're after it, but, I mean, these various nationalist struggles are resolved sooner or later, aren't they? I know they go on for years and years, decades and decades.
I think Zimbabwe answers that very well. Nationalist struggles are resolved from time to time. People all of a sudden win some major concession from their lords and they think they've actually, you know, solved the problem for all time. But so long as the fundamental discontent which led them to wage wars in the first place, discontent with their living standards, with the fact that they are powerless, with the fact that they must starve in the midst of plenty so often, those contradictions and that discontent, if it lives on, even into the new Zimbabwe and the new Irish Republic, clearly it's going to cause the same sort of problems, the same sort of struggles again in the future. So that although the Irish may well solve their problems, you know, in the short term, although the Republic may well extend over the 32 counties, for all I know, and the British troops pull out, because that would, many politicians argue, that would be the most sensible solution to the present crisis, and would certainly allow the British government to wash their hands of this crazy problem that they have. Now, although that might happen, the Irish people at the end of the day would still be left with all of the misery and the hunger and the starvation which initially gave rise to the nationalist movement, and they would just have to find something else to rail against, something else to fight about, some other cause to take up, until finally perhaps they stumbled on the realization that we have tried to put across for so long, that the only way to do away with the problems of capitalism is to do away with capitalism itself.
Yes.
Well, this is a question actually arising from the gentleman who just spoke there, you see. While I agree that the answer to the world's problem is exactly the socialist answer, nevertheless, if we take the situation in Ireland, it must be, if you like, seen as a separate thing, because it's an immediate situation which this country, I mean this island, and that island there are in conflict. When we talk about the war, since 1969, actually, it is about 600 years going on, this war, you see? And I agree, for a start, with anybody, that the death of one British soldier in any part of Ireland, in that part of Ireland, is one too many. But nevertheless, the Irish cannot end the war, when Mr. Cook, I think is his name, when he said the Irish end the war, it's not in the hands of the Irish to win the war, you see. And I would like to see peace there tomorrow morning rather than the morning afterwards. But I do understand that there can never be any peace there, that peace can only end there, you know what I mean? Or that the war can only end there and peace can only be gained, if that's what we're talking about, as a separate situation, not about worldwide socialism. It can only end there, the violence, with the end of British rule, because that's where it started. And it can only end where it started.
Who would you like to answer the question? Either speaker?
Either speaker, both.
Yes, Clifford, would you like to? Yes. Could I answer that by clarifying what I perhaps didn't have time to clarify before, which is what we are, in very positive terms, proposing that we actually do, because we are a party of action. We're not just running this meeting to analyse the situation, we're running this meeting to urge every single one of you to take some action. And that is that you refer to it as something being an immediate problem, and of course we couldn't agree more. But what we want to add to that is that it's an immediate problem in the same way that a million other problems are very immediate. You could say, I say a million because there's one for every person on earth at least. And that is that at the moment, in Britain as a whole, 1% of the population possess between them more wealth than 80% of the population. Now that's the first point. You've got an extreme concentration of wealth. Second point is that in Northern Ireland, there are a number of industries which have some connections with British ownership, Protestant ownership, British ownership. That, in a nutshell, is why the army is there. Armies are there to defend property. Now, of course, if 80% of the population between us can't even gather together in our own pockets as much wealth as the 1% at the top, we must be pretty impoverished. And that's hard for some people to accept, because they say, well, I can't because I've got a television. But that's neither here nor there. If between all of us we've got less wealth than 1%, who I doubt are in this meeting, then we are impoverished, relatively speaking. And it doesn't matter if you're Protestant or Catholic, or if you earn £4,000 a year or £20,000 a year. If you're in that class which has to work to produce wealth, and in return
just gets peanuts in a paper bag or even a salary check in the bank, but has to keep going back working every Monday morning. And if you stop for 1 week, you've had it. Then obviously you're in the working class, whatever the pretensions some people have may be. Now, what we're advocating for the workers in Ireland, of either religion, and the soldiers, and everybody here, is that the working class, as I've just described it, which is all of us, has to unite politically. In other words, you join a movement, you join an organisation. People don't necessarily like joining organisations, I know I don't, but it's a necessity. You have to join together organisationally, with all of the headaches that that may impose for some people in terms of actually having to get up and do something complicated compared to sitting back and just watching the rubbish on the box the whole time. Having done that, we have to then withdraw our consent to this system. Because the fact of the matter is, the whole system, whether it's in Belfast or Cross MacLean or Neasden, is based upon consent to that system. In other words, people in some degree or another accept the system. However reluctantly they do so, ultimately they accept it, because the majority of people go to the ballot boxes, time in, time out, and vote for one of three or four parties which in some form or another run this system. And if somebody is in the business of running a system, then whatever their intentions are, they are part of that system politically, and people are voting for them. And therefore, we are still giving our consent, sometimes without even realising it. Now, so that's my second point. We withdraw our consent. How do we do that? We set up this movement, which is a political movement. It's political because it's to do with taking power away from the minority who've got it, and that's what politics means, taking power. Except in the case of the Labour Party and the Tory Party and the others, politics means getting power, but in our politics, it means taking it away from them. And you put it in the hands of all of us. Now, it's clear, I would hope, from what I've said, that if you do that, the whole Irish problem is a nonentity, because obviously if the workers of the world controlled and owned the wealth of the world, in other words, if you get up on a Monday morning, you go into a factory, you go into an office, you produce wealth and it's yours. In other words, collectively we own it. We don't hand it over to the shareholders. You know, we don't get told at 5 o'clock to go home and leave the wealth in the warehouse so that its owners can market it and profit from it. We take it with us if we want to, because it's ours. Now that is a revolutionary proposal. It's a radical proposal. It's one which the vast majority of workers in every part of the world have not yet positively supported. This party exists to urge workers to support that proposal and to act. And there are a number of ways you can act. We're producing literature such as this, which contains that proposal. It actually urges workers to act, to take what we've spent hundreds of years producing. Now that's logical. There's no logical argument against that. I defy anyone here to think of one. If you've been producing wealth for hundreds of years, whether it's the Harland and Wolff shipyards, you know, whether it's ICI or Unilever, you've been producing wealth for hundreds of years. It does not belong to us because 1% of the population monopolise it all. Now therefore, what we're proposing is that we form this political movement whose express aim, and only aim, is to do that. Now, okay, you may come back at us and you may say the Irish problem is immediate, it's pressing, and there must be something we can do to improve the Irish situation, which is not quite the same as what I'm talking about. Now, I don't know if you're saying that or not. Don't worry if you're not. Don't worry if you're not, because a lot of people do say that, whether you are or not. They do say that. And our answer to that point is that there is nothing that we can do which will fundamentally improve the system. Okay, there are things you might be able to do which would slightly improve it. We don't deny that. After years and years and years of struggle and murders and killing and fighting and struggling and spending every single morsel of your energy, you might, by doing something within capitalism, improve it. What we're saying is that you can't afford to approach the problem that way. We have to actually make it our business as revolutionaries to take every one of these issues and make them all immediate. We have to say that if we spend the next 5 years trying to, in some way, reform the Irish situation, whether it's getting the British troops out or putting more in, whatever it may be, if we spend the next 5 years trying to do that, then the capitalist world system based upon power blocks and based upon competition and based upon lucrative markets and all the rest of it may blow itself to pieces. And it's not going to look very good if we're back here in 5 years' time, or rather not back here, because we've been blown to pieces in a nuclear war. And somebody says, well, we were fighting hard to solve the hunger problem, or the island problem, or one other individual problem. We did our bit, but the system's blown itself to pieces. But that's not going to look very good. What we've therefore got to do is that we've got to say, yes, the Irish problem must be acted upon, but so must the hunger problem, and the war problem, and all of the other problems. And that is not as complicated as it sounds, because in fact, every single one of these problems has the same cause. the cause of every single one of these problems. And we can demonstrate this with numerous examples. In every case, these problems are all caused by the system which exists. So that stands to reason, because if you've got wars in the world, and if you've got a certain system in the world, then those wars logically must arise out of that system. And so does the hunger, so does the starvation, because if you're hungry and you haven't got money, the rule of the system is you can't eat. There's one person dying of starvation each second. And if they haven't got money to buy food, they die. That's the system you live in. So what I'm saying to you is it is an immediate problem, but so are these others. And that's why our answer to the first question, because it's related, can you solve the Irish problem within capitalism? Our answer is that the problems which we're concerned about, such as those slums that I described to you, such as the constant deaths and violence, cannot be solved within capitalism. If they could, we would be out doing it tomorrow, because we're not into some kind of abstract game where you replace capitalism by socialism. We couldn't care less about that. What we're into doing is solving the real problems, and we believe that the only way you can do that ultimately is by getting rid of capitalism.
Well, can I just say this now?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, I think actually Peter would like, he would like to respond as well.
Can I get more like this?
Yes, please.
I respect what Clifford Slapper has said. In the wider part, of course, Ireland's problems within the capitalist system will not be solved when all soldiers are out and when the border is gone. But if we take it separate, and I have to take it separate again, because after all, that's what we're talking about. There is a war going on, and you refer to it as a war, and so does everybody else refer to it as a war. Although Mr. Morning, when the troops were there first, he said it was a handful of trunks, and a Saturday night in Belfast. But later on they said it was a war. So it is a war, if you like. And a very vicious war as well. Now, how do we go about stopping that war, if you like? And I say again, and the only thing I can say, you see what I mean? To stop that war, you see, to stop that war, the border has to go. The dividing line has to go. And that might be harder done than anybody might imagine. But nevertheless, that is the grim prospect that it will have to go in the end if we do want, peace there for once and for all. And the army has to be withdrawn. Because as Ken Livingstone said, and I don't even know Ken, he said, you see, the IRA will be always there because they'll be always born there. If you can't remove the cause, then the war goes on. And of course, the war, the cause of the war in Ireland, not only since 1921, since that state was set up, incidentally by the British, not any vote of the Irish, either Catholic or Protestant, was an imposed border on them. Now, to finish the war, in my estimation, that border has to be withdrawn, and these people have to be left there together to solve their own problems, whether it is socialism they want, or whatever they might like to have. Nevertheless, they've got to be in the position, you know what I mean? Where there is no tanks and no soldiers running up and down outside their streets. See? Or no prop to the mill and props and so on.
You know, what's the question?
No, that is that's the only way the war can be.
On the matter of war, you made the point that one soldier dying in Ulster is one too many.
One too many.
If I can just say this. This is a statement which owes more to moral indignation, really, than to a realistic appraisal of the situation, because such deaths are required from time to time in capitalism. They can only become one too many when capitalism, the system of conditions which necessitate slaughter for the profit of the few, when capitalism is abolished. Wars aren't confined to Ulster. They do range over the whole world. They range over the whole world right now, and Ulster, no matter whether you're Irish or whatever, wherever you come from, cannot be regarded as the one war, or the most important war in anyone's view. Only when we abolish wars worldwide will the worldwide system, which causes wars worldwide, be done away with. Only when we do away with barriers and political groupings like the IRA at root, rather than tamper with barriers and political and borders and political groups, can we ensure that once and for all, wars everywhere will go? I mean, we have borders now all over the place. How on earth can changing a border between two countries or two states...
I know, away the border. I didn't say changing it. Doing away the border, you rightly said.
He will still have borders outside. He will still have borders between people right across the world. Although taking away the border in Ireland may temporarily alleviate the situation. As I've said, you can alleviate it, you cannot cure it. And if you, as an Irishman or as any working man or woman, devote all your attentions to papering over the problem, to bringing about some cosmetic change which in the short term can help you, your family, your relatives, those closest to you, if you devote all your energies and your life to that, then there's no one left at the end of the day to carry on the fight for socialism, the only cause which really can do away with war and with borders and with political groups like the IRA once and for all. And that's why we advocate that. One final point I'd just like to make. You did say that the Irish should be left to themselves to bring socialism.
Well, what I mean, there'd be, you know, no pulling, no outside interference. Didn't they have to make up their mind?
Well, if you think, my friend, that there is any country in the world, no matter how apparently free, where there is no outside interference on the working people who want to bring about socialism.
I didn't mean in that sense. Well, what I am trying to say, Charles,
can you keep it short? There's a couple of other people who want to
If your brother gets away from them, well then, they've got to make up their mind as to what they want.
Maybe we'll come back to that.
Yes. Well, I think as a socialist, shouldn't we be concerned about where the troops come out of Ireland? As one particular part of the planet, we should be looking for troops out of the world, whether to take them out of Northern Ireland. I see the less obvious ones in Aldershot just down the street here is the question you should be looking at. Although they're not marching up and down the Pentonville Road at the moment with SLRs with 20 rounds of ammunition in their hands, they're still obvious in the part of the territorial army is passage out almost every day, and they're quite prepared should there any troubles of a serious nature in Northern Ireland were to occur in London or elsewhere in Great Britain to do exactly the same here. So as a socialist, I would say, how do we get at the troops? Are they susceptible to ideas as other members of the working class in Catholics or Protestants? And I would say yes, I've served in Northern Ireland as a soldier, and I saw there several instances which inspires me as yet to understand that socialist ideas given to any member of the working class, they're capable of understanding them.
The important point to come out of that is that everywhere working people are split up into groups, each of which thinks that it has a special problem or a special message to put across or a special role to change the world in which it lives. The groups may be divided up on the basis of religion, on the basis of sex, on the basis of national boundaries, on the basis of all kinds of distinctions which we love to draw between one man and the next man, or one man and the next woman, in order that we have a sense of belonging, a sense of being special, and a sense of having power in a world in which really we are powerless. And so long as people think of themselves in those terms as Protestant or Catholic or soldiers or police or in any such grouping, there is bound to be conflict and there are bound to be wars, and the solution has to be to show people that in fact they have an identity of interests, that there is no future for any of them in continuing these sterile conflicts, and that the joking around with borders or with any other sort of artificial division cannot really bring about an end to the problems which they all feel so strong. And that's what we are about.
Yes.
My problem is linked to the most important point, because I'm very apprehensive with the fact that although in the so-called West, I mean, they're supposed to be troops that are loyal to the government, but I don't think they are. They are loyal to just the same 1% that Cliff was talking about, because I mean, a typical example would be the Vietnam War, where everybody in the States really opposed the Vietnam War, practically everybody, but they still waged the war until the big guys really felt that it was good. The time was good and right for them to withdraw without losing face.